Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you're listening to The Current.
Pauline Dacon, CBC News, Halifax.
We're starting with the CBC's Pauline Dacon.
Pauline Dacon, CBC News, Halifax.
If you are a regular CBC listener, you are likely familiar with Pauline Dacon's name and voice. It's safe to say you don't know her story. The longtime CBC reporter, producer, and host is now an assistant professor at the University of King's College School of Journalism. But she's also been at work reporting her own life story in a new book, Run, Hide, Repeat, a memoir of a fugitive childhood. It tells a gripping story of a childhood spent on the run, and there are some incredible twists as this tale unfolds. Twice without any notice, Pauline's mother moves her and her brother across the country, wrenching them from their daily lives with no explanation. There are odd, unexplained events, break-ins, car thefts, and a palpable sense that something menacing is looming over their life. But just who or what were always questions that remained unanswered until one day in 1988, when a 23-year-old Pauline Dacon met her mother at the Bluebird Hotel in Sussex, New Brunswick. Here is Pauline Dacon reading from her book.
I walked over to Mum's car and got in, said hello, leaning across for a hug. She held me just a beat longer, tighter than normal. As she pulled back, her smile was sad, almost apologetic. She handed me a note and an empty envelope. She put one finger over her lips, hushing me, although I wasn't speaking. She pointed at the note. Puzzled, I unfolded it and read in her distinctive handwriting, "Don't say anything. Take all your jewelry off and put it in the envelope. Don't talk until we get out of the car again. I will explain."
Pauline Dacon reading from her book. Pauline Dacon joins me from our Halifax studio. Hi.
Hi, Anna Maria.
What was it that your mother had to say to you that day at the Bluebird Motel?
Well, she was there with a longtime family friend who surprised me with his presence as well. And they sat me down and they told me that all the odd things that had happened while I was growing up and while my brother was growing up was because we had been on the run from the mafia. And that's why we had disappeared twice. That's why we would suddenly, without notice, go on a hiking trip. Oh, but we're missing school. Oh, it's okay. So strange things happen. And so the mafia was an ongoing threat in our lives. And part of the reason for that, they told me, was that my father had been involved in the mafia in Vancouver.
So much to absorb.
Oh, yeah.
Why did she have you hand over your jewelry?
Because there was concern that perhaps there would be listening devices in my jewelry, particularly the jewelry that had been a gift from my father or his wife.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there was a family friend there, Stan Sears. Tell us a little bit about who Stan was and what role he played in this.
I first knew Stan Sears as the minister at a United Church we started going to when I was, six. This really kind of outgoing, friendly guy. What I didn't know was at the time, my mother was in the process of leaving my dad, and she was very fearful, and he was alcoholic. And so she'd gone to Al-Anon, and she was suffering from depression. And at Al-Anon, somebody said, "Well, you really need to go and see Stan Sears. He works with a lot of the family members, and he's a really great guy, and we think he could help you." And she did that. And sure enough, over about 6 months, her depression began to lift, and she could see the way forward, and she did leave my dad. And then she needed to get work, so she became his secretary for a period of time. His other one had retired, and so she filled in.
I should stop you. He was a clergyman.
He was a clergyman. He was with the United Church of Canada. He had some training in psychology, and so that was, why he was used in the community as a counselor as well. And so that night when I was 23 in the motel room trying to make sense of all of this, I kept saying, "Yeah, but why us? But why us?" And so Stan told me the story about how before he'd ever met my mother, he had been doing counseling with somebody who'd been involved at a high level with the mob on the waterfront in Vancouver. And he'd been counseling this man who was regretful and repentful and wanted to change his life. And the mafia found out and they killed him. And so that's how Stan had come to the mafia's attention. Then when my mother began going to him for counseling and then working for him, what he said was that the mafia realized or felt that they were sort of sharing my mother was sharing information and that they were probably going to authorities with information about them.
And again, because your father was involved, mm-hmm. they said, with the mafia as well.
That was the thinking, that because, you know, my mother would have information, supposedly from the time they were together, that she would be sharing that information with Stan.
And the story they told you became even more complex. What was the place of hope?
The place of hope was a shadowy, secretive, we called it inside, we called it the weird world. So what it was kind of a very secret penal institution that was only for people who were arrested because of their involvement with organized crime. And what they told me was that this organization reported only to the Privy Council. It received its funding through military budgets, that people who were arrested and imprisoned there were tried by military tribunals. So there was a penal part of the place, but also he called it inside because it was also a place where people whose lives had gotten caught up with the mafia through no fault of their own, but who had become targets of the mafia, could be taken there for their own safety. They could go inside to be safe. And by the time Stan was telling me this, he was telling me that he had gone inside. He'd been a big target because he told me he'd started to work with the Weird World, this group, the Anti-Organized Crime Task Force. So he'd gone to work with them and become even more of a target, and therefore my family was even more of a target.
And he told you he had protectors.
Yes. So part of what the Weird World did was provide protection for people like my family who had, for some reason, become targets. And so I was asked, would I agree to have a locating beacon put on my car so that the people who protected me and followed me, what they called my coverage, would have an easier time keeping track of me and making sure everything was okay around me. And I was given a special little radio, looked just like a little transistor radio from the 70s. And I was instructed on a special way that I could put the settings to call for help if I've ever felt my life was in danger.
And he communicated with these protectors. How did he do that?
I called it the butt receiver. He had a vibrator, a little vibration tool in the lining of his wallet, and he could get messages through that. You know, it would be kind of like the Morse code of vibration in his wallet pocket.
And you saw him actually take notes from this. What was that like? What did he do?
Well, as things went on, and sometimes I would end up being asked to go on the run with Stan and Mom because something was going on that was threatening, I would see him occasionally pull a notepad and start making all of these notes in numbers and letters, and then he would sort of figure out the message afterwards, and he'd look at the cipher and figure it out and come back with a message.
So they told you this one night in this motel, totally by surprise. You were not expecting this. How did you react to all of it?
Well, you know, I was a young journalist, but I did understand, you know, the value of critical thinking and healthy skepticism. And my first reaction was, you're crazy. This is crazy. Nobody could keep this kind of a secret. A world like that would not be kept secret. So, you know, that was my initial reaction. And then I started to think, well, God, if this is true,
maybe I should go to Australia. Maybe I could get lost somewhere in the world. I don't want this to be part of my life. The other thing that Mom had told me was that she was getting ready to go inside, that she wanted to go inside. And after so many years on the run, she was exhausted, and that was her plan. But, you know, as my thinking evolved during that weekend, but also in the weeks that followed, I just had to think that, you know, here are these two people, good people, people who were very idealistic, who were doing good things in the community, who showed nothing but empathy and for the world around them. And they had been the two people I could most trust in my life. They were always there for me. Stan ultimately had become like a father to me. And they never once in my life let me down. And I thought, wow, you know, if I can't believe these two people of all people, the game is over anyway. You know, what's the point of anything? And so I eventually decided I had to believe this because of who was telling it to me. I was never without doubts. I struggled with it mightily, but I always came back to that. It's Stan and Mom, and I trust them.
Mm. Now, your parents were divorced. What was your relationship like with your dad during your childhood?
My dad was alcoholic, so there were periods of time I didn't see him, and he struggled with that disease. When there were some court-ordered visitation, my father and mother had been in a very long and ugly court battle over access and child support payments and so on. For a period of time, I did see him before we left Vancouver, but then that summer that we supposedly went on vacation to the prairies, we didn't tell him we told him we were going on vacation, but then we never went back and we didn't talk to him again for a very long time. So I, for great parts of my life, I had no relationship with my dad.
And tell me a little bit more about your childhood. You had about a sense of fear in your childhood.
Yeah, you know, there was always a sense that something was wrong, but we could never put our finger on it. My brother and I used to debrief this. What do you think this is all about? Because even if we were just going on a vacation or out for dinner, we were just always told, don't talk about this. Don't tell anybody this. Well, why can't we tell the simplest things in our lives? So there was this sense of secretiveness all the time. And that something bad was going on.
Give me an example of some of the unexplained or disturbing events then that you saw as a child.
Well, one time I came home from school and we were very quickly ushered out the door and told that we couldn't be in the house because the furnace was malfunctioning. And then that weekend at the Bluebird Motel, I was told, now, you remember that? Well, what was actually happening is that people were coming after us. So we were getting everybody out to be safe. And I guess, you know, the one that really rattled me was one time when we came home and we were told, well, we're going over to the Sears for a sleepover. So the other thing you need to know is that every time we disappeared, Stan and his wife disappeared with us. That, of course, always seemed very strange. We were moving around the country in lockstep. So this was in Winnipeg, and we were told we were going to their house for a sleepover, which seemed odd because it was a school night, and I didn't realize that adults did sleepovers like that. Mm. So we had this very strained dinner and then went to bed, and I was just going to sleep when there was this terrible ruckus in the basement. It sounded like things being thrown around. It sounded like a big fight. And I put the light on. I was so scared. It was that moment where, like in a nightmare where you know, somebody's coming at you and you can't run because you're frozen. I was frozen with fear. And Mom came into my room and Ted was in the room across the hall and Stan and Sybil were out in the hallway. And they came in, they said, it's okay, it's the dog. The dog is all upset. And that just did not make any sense with what I was hearing. And then, of course, years later, I was told about that, that some Italian mafia people had actually come across the pond and come after us. And there were some of the good guys, our guys, our coverage was waiting in the basement. And what I heard was the mafia guys coming through the window and our guys fighting them off, and that, in fact, people were killed that night.
Mm. And Sybil, of course, is Sybil Sears, his wife.
That's right.
And again, so these were odd events that you remember from your childhood, but that night in the motel, they tell you this is why, and they can actually point to things that now make some kind of sense to you.
Right. Yeah. As Mom said, you always wanted to know. Well, here it comes. And that was part of the reason that, it's so strange, but it makes some kind of sense when those puzzle pieces all start coming together and there is an explanation for so many things that were so strange.
Okay, so you're 23 years old and you find this out, and you're working at the Telegraph Journal, right, out of St. John at the time?
Yep.
Okay. So after you know this, in the years immediately after your mom and Stan make this revelation to you, what is your life like?
Increasingly, my life felt just completely irrelevant. I just couldn't talk to anybody about any of this, and this was taking up a large space in my head. I was afraid. I was told that people were following me for my protection, but that still felt creepy. And of course, I was always trying to spot them. And I never knew, when somebody might be coming after me. So I regarded the world with a lot of suspicion. I still had some doubts that I was struggling with, but, deciding that I had to take this seriously in case.
And you couldn't talk to anybody. You were living with a boyfriend at the time, but you couldn't tell him anything.
I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell my best friends. I was told, you can't tell anybody this. It could put people's lives in jeopardy. So I told nobody, and I found myself increasingly isolated. And somehow, the idea that I would go to work and go cover some council meeting or school board meeting or something, I thought, what's the point of all that? It just seemed so irrelevant when all of this big, threatening, crazy stuff was going on in the background.
And you've still got this little device he gave you. You're putting it in every purse, you move it around, you keep it with you in case you need to call for help.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was always there. I was told never to be outdoors without it.
And so now you know, and you're part of the inside knowledge, and things are still happening. Give me an example. There's one that really is at the front of my mind, the story of the boat full of injured and dying refugees who've been trafficked. Mm-hmm. What was the story? What happened?
Well, we were on the run. Stan was visiting. By this time, he had retired to the West Coast and then gone inside. But he was back and out and visiting, and we were asked to leave town. So he and Mom and I got in the car and drove to Cape Breton. And I was told that that was good because rural areas, it was easier to keep us safe with fewer people around. So we were up there, and we suddenly I could see him taking notes, and that there was something going on. And this was quite a frequent occurrence. He would be getting messages. And sometimes the message was, take the next right. We're checking out a car behind you to see if they follow, that kind of thing. This time he was obviously very upset. And he said that he was getting messages that a ship had been found floating just off the coast of Nova Scotia, and when it was boarded, they found that it was, he called it a death ship. It was a bunch of illegal immigrants from the U.S., or who had been in the U.S., who had had their organs harvested. They'd been kidnapped for the black market in organs. And so that when they went on board that ship, we were told that there were people who were dead because all their organs were gone. There were people who were dying, and there were people below in a hold that didn't know what was going on. And there had been surgeons on board, organized crime people who had been scared off and had just left the boat to drift.
That's just like so upsetting. And you're a reporter. Mm-hmm. You can't share that, obviously, either, right?
Like, right. Oh, there were so many times that there were stories that I thought, oh, my gosh, I could make my career with this story. You know, this is amazing. But no, I couldn't tell it.
And so Stan is living in BC because he's living in the place of hope.
Yep.
But he comes back. And like, what's the explanation that the feds are paying for him to come back?
Yes, that, you know, he became his work with this organization got to be a bigger and bigger part of his life. And he became a leader in that community. And that the government, he worked within that military budget. And so that's how he got around. There was an aircraft, a military aircraft that he called the Bird. And he would sometimes fly in on the Bird. And other times he would take what he called very risky commercial flights. And so he would be spending time here quite frequently.
And by this time, you know, and they are very open with the fact that your mom and Stan are in a relationship. They've fallen in love.
Yeah, yeah.
And Stan has a wife, but she, you're told, knows this, or they... That was dealt, that relationship and this one, that issue had been dealt with long ago, kind of thing.
Yes, that they had gone back to retire. He had bought her a place on the West Coast and then gone inside, and that their relationship ended when he went inside because she didn't want to. She wanted to stay outside.
And we're forgetting another point of this, Pauline. Your dad was an investment guy. And one of the things they also told you was that he had put your name as part of, like, the sort of in his work with the mob, that you were listed in something that was related to the mob, which is why you were vulnerable as well. Am I right?
That was part of it, that a number of money laundering businesses and that kind of thing had been put in my name and my brother's name. And it was, there was the expectation that we would join that business, that we would become part of organized crime with our dad, and we were told that our half-brother and sister had been before us, and that many people we'd known around us had also been involved, you know, people that were around my dad. There was an expectation that we would get brought in.
And some of those people started writing to you.
Well, the people who started writing to me were people who had been involved and then been arrested and taken to the weird world. And they were imprisoned in the weird world. And then some of them had ultimately changed and became trusted and began to do jobs in the weird world. I received letters and lots of them from people who had known me as a small child, and they were writing to ask me to forgive them for the things that they'd been involved in that had harmed my family and sent us running.
And they knew things about you as a child. They were very familiar letters.
Yes, I had letters from people who had been neighbors, my godparents, my half-siblings who I was told had been arrested and now were there. Yeah, people who knew things about me.
Your brother doesn't know anything yet?
Not yet.
Okay. So so they've told you this story about the mafia, and they made it clear that you, too, are a target. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you realize you should go into permanent hiding with Stan and your mom to this place of hope. That was a pretty drastic turn for somebody so young to think that you have to go into hiding permanently like that.
Yeah, it was definitely desperation. You know, I just found it so difficult to live a normal life when I knew, or I was always being told about all these things, other things going on around me. As I say, it isolated me. It made me feel distant from the people in my life. It made my life's work feel less relevant to me. And I thought, oh, what the hell? I'm going inside. You know, and I was told that there would be work for me there and that there was a community of people that would welcome me. I was told there would be a horse for me because Stan knew I really liked horses when I was young. I would be welcomed.
So here we are, after a childhood full of questions, sudden moves across the country, a sense that something is wrong, the revelation that the mob is after them. That seems to explain a lot about Pauline Dakin's childhood, but there's still more to this story. And Pauline Dakin is in our Halifax studio. Hello again.
Hi, Anna Maria.
So you've been told this incredible story of your mom being on the run with you kids, you and your brother, your younger brother, and your childhood on the run from the mob. Something isn't sitting right with you. You have doubts about their story.
Yeah, always there were doubts. And when that happened, it was a terrible agony, you know. Do I believe these people that I trust, who have never given me any reason not to trust them? In fact, quite the opposite, have been the most reliable people in my life. And so I kept coming back to that. But, you know, as we would be running together, we'd be traveling to get away from some kind of threat, I began to notice strange little inconsistencies and patterns that just alerted me that something wasn't quite right. Stan knew so much, had so many stories about this, what had gone on in the weird world and all the people who lived there. It just seemed incomprehensible that anybody could make this stuff up. But something wasn't quite right.
Mm. But at the same time, like a couple of years are going by, you are trying to live your life. You get engaged. Your brother eventually finds out about this. Mm-hmm.
And I did not go inside, and my mother did not go inside, and we were told it was because there were threats that if either one of us disappeared again, that our remaining family on the West Coast would suffer for it. So, yeah, we were still outside for a long period of time, and I had begun to lose hope that that would ever happen.
And as you do that, you start looking at these inconsistencies again, and that brings us to another part of this story, the truth. When did you seriously doubt this story your mom and Stan were telling you?
There were a number of incidents that that built the case, I guess. I told you about the little radio that I was given, and my brother was given the same radio, and he and his wife, he married quite young, and they were traveling through Vancouver one night and thought that they were being chased. And so he pulled over, this is in the pre-cell phone era, he pulled over to a payphone he'd also been given a 1-800 number. So yeah, one time he pulled over and went to a payphone and called the 1-800 number or the number, and it didn't work. There was no answer. And then another time when he thought something was going on, he'd used the little radio receiver, and again, nothing happened. So he lost faith very quickly. Now, you know, when these things happen, the answer always came back, well, oh, this is serious. This is going to require an investigation. We have to find out why you didn't, you know. And it would come back that somebody mistakenly cut a line or, you know, something like that.
There was always an answer, right?
Always.
Pre-cell phone era, what years are we talking about?
We're talking about the late 80s, early to mid 90s.
Okay. And so your brother has these inconsistencies that he starts to share. Keep going.
I'm also noticing kind of an odd thing. My mother was all about, you know, trust. If we don't have trust, we don't have anything. Tell me the truth every time. I don't care how hard it is. It's better than a lie, that kind of thing. And I, a couple of times I saw her get very upset with Stan because she thought he told her something that wasn't the truth. And I watched how he deflected her anger by bringing up the death of his son. He'd had a son die. And he would, you know, get very sad, and she would say, what? And he'd say, well, I just found out something about Michael, his son. The second time I saw that happen, he just knew that my mother had such empathy for that loss that she could not press him when he was feeling sadness about it. And I thought, that seems like he's using that sadness. So eventually, I just couldn't live with the uncertainty of the situation, and I decided I have to know. So I guess I set up a bit of a sting to find out one way or the other whether there was any truth in this whole story.
What did you do?
Well, I waited until I knew that Stan would be in the area visiting my mother. And then I called her and I said, my house has been broken into. What should I do? And she said, our friend is here. Of course, she would talk that way because in case anybody was listening on the phone. And she said, our friend is here. I'll check and I'll get right back to you. And then I hung up and I just sat waiting. And she calls back and she said, yes, we know about that break-in. There were two people. We've picked them up down the street in a car. The car had your pictures in the back. They'd been watching you. They were looking for the china that your father sent you. And in that moment, I just knew the whole thing is a lie. Our whole lives are a lie. It was excruciating.
It must have been devastating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have a physical reaction to that?
Oh, yeah. I thought I was going to be sick. And, of course, I was shaking. I was shaking when I made the call. I was still shaking. I was aware that by doing this, I was turning our lives back upside down again. And my whole understanding had to change again.
So much of the story seems fantastical. You go to a wedding and you're told that the family has body doubles, mm-hmm. and that the aunt that you're looking at, you know, isn't. It's an actor, and they've like even right down to the way she does something with her toes and her sandals. Everything, mm-hmm. like the Canadian government's figured this out, and they're protecting you all. And it's a very deep rabbit hole, huh?
It really was, yeah. Mm. Yeah, the doubles were, you know, a very disturbing thing to get your head around. But, you know, the argument was Winston Churchill had a double. Lots of people have had doubles. You know, we spend months training our doubles. But, of course, organized crime does too. So you never know which double you're looking at. It was mind-bending.
Right, and we know people go into witness protection. So it's just like a stretch from that. And so did you confront Stan and your mom at some point?
I confronted my mom first. I honestly believed, I knew she had to believe this because I knew she would never fool us. She would never do anything to hurt me and Ted. She really, honesty was her highest value, really. And so I knew that she was following his lead. So I decided to try with her first. And I told her, and she was so upset. But what she was upset about was that if I didn't believe the story, it meant that I might put myself in danger. I might put myself at risk.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I should have said spoiler alert here, but there's so much in this book that we're not going to take away from anyone's sense of suspense or awe as they read through your story, Pauline. But if it wasn't the mafia, why did Stan and your mom tell you all this?
Well, in my mom's case, you know, she met Stan at a time that she was so vulnerable, you know, leaving a marriage she'd been abused in. And, you know, she had not had a great relationship with her dad either. He was abusive in some ways. And then she met this man who she always said saved her life. She said that she'd been suicidal by the time she met him, and she credited him with saving her. And he was a gentle guy, and he was a good guy. He, you know, he was right-thinking. He was a great preacher and very interested in social justice. And so she had huge admiration for him. So that's why my mother believed it. Until the day she died, in fact. With Stan, though, that was always the question. Why would he do this to us? He was like a dad to me. Why would he ever do this? And it was the mystery. I nearly turned myself inside out trying to figure that out over the years that followed. Obviously, once I decided I didn't believe, I was now an outsider. You know, I retained a relationship with my mother and to a degree with Stan as well. But, we were on opposite sides of a pretty vast chasm. And I knew that he loved me. I loved him. Why? And then some years later, I happened to read an article in a medical journal and all the lights went off and I went, that's why. This article talked about an underdiagnosed, underrecognized, understudied condition that's quite rare called delusional disorder. It's far more rare, for example, than schizophrenia. Although, in reality, I think people who have specialty in that area would say we don't really know how common it is because people who have this condition typically don't go looking for help.
And they're very good at hiding it.
Well, depending on their intelligence, you know, somebody with high intelligence suffering from this, oh, yeah, they can fool all kinds of people.
So what is delusional disorder? What did you learn about it?
Okay, well, it involves delusions, but non-bizarre delusions. Now, you may say, Pauline, that's all pretty bizarre. And it is. But, you know, with somebody with schizophrenia, for example, they have the kind of delusion that they maybe are hearing voices or somebody sending signals from space, things that are clearly not possible, not reasonable. With delusional disorder, the delusions are, yes, maybe very unlikely or unusual, but they're possible. Not probable, but possible. And then they, you know, if they are intelligent people, they can build entire worlds. And it's kept in kind of an envelope. So they can, you know, live very normal looking lives. Quite often people with this condition are diagnosed a little bit later in life. So they tend to be educated. Maybe they've had a family. They're established in a career.
So this they have is Stan.
That
you're explaining, yeah.
Yeah, and they have credentials in the world, so they're not suspect initially. And then something tips, and I don't think anybody can tell you what actually goes on in the brain. There's lots of theories, but they begin to develop delusions. And there are subtypes of this condition. You know, you probably would have heard of the erotomanic subtype of delusional disorder. This is where you hear about somebody who's been chasing a Hollywood star because they think that that person is in love with them, has been sending them messages that, you know, they want to connect.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally you hear about that one, or you might hear about one that's called somatic, where somebody thinks that they have maybe something growing under their skin or they emit a bad smell. And those people do look for help. They go to see doctors who, you know, can't find anything wrong. But in Stan's case, the two subtypes that I think were at play, and others have backed me up on this, is persecutory, where you believe that somebody's coming after you, trying to harm you, is plotting against you. And I would say that was kind of the primary one. And the second one being grandiosity, where you have some secret knowledge or ability that other people don't have. And when I read everything I could get my hands on about this condition, those things really described Stan for me. You know, it was him to a T. And so I got in touch with the guy who wrote this article in the journal, and his name is Theo Manschreck. He's a psychiatrist at Harvard in Boston. And we spent a long time on the phone. He spent a long time saying, wow, really? Wow. He thought this was interesting because you don't hear a lot about these cases. He said a psychiatrist could typically work an entire career and never see one of these people.
And you were living it, so you could document.
Yep.
After the fact. Well, I mean, you talk about they have to be high intellect, because that's the thing that struck me as well. What kind of intellect do you have to create such a sophisticated web of not only lies, but of concrete examples? Like, you had all these letters from people who knew things about you. Your mom had a huge collection of letters. He put a lot of work into this.
Oh, and how did he do that and have a career and all, you know, he was involved in all kinds of things in the community, and I don't know. I mean, there are things about this story that will always be a mystery to me. How did he pay to be flying back and forth across the country? I don't know. I managed to track down his son in BC, and we had a visit.
And did they know about this?
They had some indicators, but he said, his name is John, and he said, until I sat there and told my story, he didn't know whether it was real or not. His dad, just at the time that his dad was meeting my mom, he was noticing strange things at home. And, you know, he would come in and say, oh, there's danger out there tonight. You know, there are people with guns. You can't go out there, that kind of thing. Eventually, John said, look, that's ridiculous. And unless you want to prove something to me, stop talking to me about it. And so, you know, I think John had always wondered, but Stan died some years ago, and so he figured he always would wonder about that. But I have to say, we had quite an interesting conversation.
Mm. And so Stan has died, your mother has died, and your dad has died, right?
Yeah, they're all gone now.
And so in some of these answers, are you certain that it was delusional disorder?
Yes, I am. I'm completely certain in my head. So, you know, Dr. Manstreck, who's, you know, one of the leading authorities on this, agrees with me when we've talked about the situation in detail. And he said to me, Pauline, you know, there's somebody who's like the world expert on this somewhere in your neck of the woods, maybe Dalhousie, which is just down a few blocks
from me. Of course, yeah.
I now work on that campus. And so I did track down Alistair Munro, who is professor emeritus at Dalhousie in the Department of Psychiatry. And we also met and talked, and he said, yes, this does seem to be what's going on here. So, you know, two very well-credentialed people with expertise in this kind of rare area have agreed that that's probably what was happening.
Mm, I have to admit to you, halfway through the book, I was starting to wonder if it was an elaborate cover-up for Stan to have an affair with your mom. But
that had crossed my mind, too.
Yeah. I mean, yep. And did you ever learn what he was telling his wife, Sybil, to explain why your mom would move you kids to follow them and, like, the whole bit about one was in one part of the country, one was in another?
Yeah, he told Sybil the same thing. She was, you know, part of the moving and believed that. I went to see her shortly before she died. And I asked her a few questions. She was, you know, quite old and quite frail, and I did not want to upset her. But I did ask her, I did say to her, you know, I've been told what was going on when I was growing up. And she said, oh, yes. And I said, do you think there's still a threat? And she said, I don't know. I just live my life. But she was in on it. You know, Stan obviously didn't go inside, and John says he continued to live with her until he died. There would be times that he would say he was going away for various reasons, and that would have been when he was on the other coast.
And you made the point that your mom believed this in some very important way, right, until she died.
She did. And my mother was, you know, she was not somebody that fell for things very easily. And so my brother and I have talked a lot about why, you know, why would she fall for this? And I think it was just, you know, a very vulnerable time in her life, and she met what she considered a very fine person. And, you know, he had... he was a minister in the United Church, and she'd been brought up in the United Church. And, you know, you respect people with those kinds of credentials and ideas in a way that we no longer do in society.
Mm, and she met him as well when she was vulnerable, and he took advantage of that.
Yes, although the interesting thing I realize now that has been transformative for my understanding and my feelings about this whole story is that, yes, he took advantage of things. And he co-opted circumstances to support the story that was being made up in his head. But he believed it, too. He never thought he was manipulating people. And it's a very bizarre thing, but I had long conversations about this and how could it be. But, yes, people can make things up to support a story and not feel that they're making it up.
And that's how he could go on living his life, even as a man of the cloth. And, you know, and I accept what you're saying, but at another level, his illness, your mom's vulnerability to believing in him, it hurt you and your brother.
Yeah. Yes, it really did. You know, there were many people that we lost touch with, people that we were, I guess, ripped away from. And there was a sense of being alone in our, you know, that we were always different. We were other.
How do you process that now?
You know, the process of writing this book, I originally decided to write this book as a way of telling my kids what had gone on in my life. And I wanted them to hear the story in a nuanced way that wouldn't have them kind of automatically judging people, including my mom. My kids were very close to my mom. And so that was originally why I wanted to try and make some sense and put it into narrative form. But the process has been remarkable for me in terms of sorting things out. I had just tried to forget about this and move on with my life. And, you know, you can only push this stuff down for so long. And so, yeah, it's been therapeutic for me. And you know, the discovery about delusional disorder has allowed me to forgive, you know, the people who harmed me because I know it was not malevolent or intentional.
Mm. And what about yourself, your own, I don't know what the word would be, your own vulnerability or delusion in believing that story? Were you hard on yourself?
Yeah.
Have you changed? Talk to me about that.
I felt a lot of shame that I had fallen for this. I'm supposed to be a journalist, for crying out loud. And I did feel a lot of shame, and also shame for, you know, other people who kind of got caught up in it because of me. I was married for a period of time and caught somebody else up in this story. I guess I had started to think differently as I, you know, was opening up the door to this again and trying to sort it all out. But I think it really had a lot to do with the way my kids reacted to this book. They read it, parts of it, while it was in the works, let me kind of forgive myself. They had, you know, their response was full of empathy for a little girl who had no control and just got caught up, and then as an adult followed the person she loved. My heart was leading my head.
Hmm. It's interesting that you say that you didn't want them judging your mom because I guess you felt that she was open to judgment.
Well, yeah. You know, if I tried to move my kids when they were, you know, 10 and 13 or something, oh, they couldn't have imagined it. And leaving behind everybody they knew.
With no explanation.
Without explanation. So, yes, I could see how easily that could turn into some judgment and so on. But my mother, you know, despite her faults and her vulnerabilities, was a remarkable person. And I wanted them to know that about her, too. And they do. You know, they have complexity of thinking on this, which pleases me very much. It's very easy to slide into black and white. But they can see the truth and still feel love.
What do you want the rest of us to learn from this story?
Well, I think the obvious one is that things aren't always as they appear, right? I appeared to have a pretty normal life most of the time, I think. The other is, I do hope people, this under-recognized illness could be hijacking a lot of other lives, too. I know it's so hard to find the people to do the studies, but it seems to me that there needs to be somebody paying more attention to this. And also, you know, there are probably kids out there that were in a similar condition to me. And I often wonder, Anna Maria, when I disappeared and, you know, didn't turn up for school on Monday, were there adults in my life at school or other places who thought, gee, I wonder what happened to her? Does anybody know? Did anybody look? Did anybody worry about these kids who just disappeared? I don't know.
Yeah, these are questions we need to ask ourselves, huh?
Yeah.
Pauline Dakin, it's a remarkable story, a remarkable life. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for being interested.
Fascinating. A lot of twists and turns, some we didn't even get to. Pauline Dakin's book is called Run, Hide, Repeat, A Memoir of a Fugitive Childhood. She joined me from our Halifax studio. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thanks for listening to The Current.